This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton came to Charlotte to pay their respects to evangelist Billy Graham. His funeral is today. President Trump is coming. We have someone on the scene. Meanwhile, President Trump's suggestion about arming classroom teachers gets the cold shoulder from CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox, our police chief, and others. CMS releases an uncomfortable report containing unpleasant truths on race, poverty, and opportunity. And candidate filings for the primaries show a number of incumbents facing challenges from within their own party. Our roundtable of reporters has details on those and other stories this hour on our local news roundup. Glenn Birkins returns. He is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Doss Helms is here, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Kirsten Garris is government reporter for Spectrum News Charlotte. She is also with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
And we're going to start with WFAE's David Borax, who is not here in the room. He is at the Billy Graham Library for the funeral of Reverend Billy Graham, which is scheduled for later today. And by the way, except for David, you can watch us all on Facebook Live. You're on your own when it comes to David. David, you had to get to the Billy Graham Library pretty early this morning because the funeral starts, I believe, at noon, and you had to take a shuttle bus in. So where are you right now?
So, Mike, right now I'm standing on a riser at the back of this large white tent that is opposite the Billy Graham Library with the glass cross that everybody's familiar with. There are a large number of media here already, and many of the guests have started to arrive. And we are waiting for everything to happen in a few hours.
This is invitation only, but how do you get there? Because they've closed the Billy Graham Parkway in both directions.
That's right. Everybody who's here today is at some kind of off-site parking with a massive shuttle bus system that they've set up. It's mostly working at the moment. We had a little trouble getting in here this morning, but you had to go through a couple of checkpoints along Billy Graham Parkway, and then there's, of course, a security screening for everybody who comes in here.
Is the security strictly because President Trump is coming, or is it traffic control for the library itself and the funeral itself? How many people are they expecting?
They're expecting about 2,000 people. I think the security is mainly because of President Trump. It's all being run by the Secret Service. It's hard to imagine that the Secret Service would come and staff a funeral like this if the dignitaries like the president and vice president weren't here.
Aside from President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence, are there other dignitaries expected to come to this thing today?
Governor Roy Cooper has said he will be here. And then the guest list includes a lot of family, friends, and former associates of Billy Graham. There are pastors from North and South Carolina and around the country, as well as internationally, who are here to pay tribute to him.
President Trump spoke about Billy Graham earlier this week at the Capitol Rotunda, where Reverend Graham became only the fourth citizen or non-government official to lie in honor there.
We can only imagine the number of lives touched by the preaching and the prayers of Billy Graham, the hearts he changed, the sorrows he eased, and the joy he brought to so many. The testimony is endless.
Do you know if the president is scheduled to speak today, David?
He is not on the program, although the program does note that he will be seated ceremonially along with his wife and Vice President Pence and his wife. And that happens at 11:50, which is 10 minutes before the service starts.
Billy Graham came home to Charlotte last weekend in a procession that wove its way through uptown Charlotte, down Tryon Street, and then worked its way over to South Boulevard for a while, back to Tryon Street, and then out to, I guess, Woodlawn Road to the Billy Graham Parkway and out to the library. I know that the Spectrum News covered that procession through downtown. How many people lined, Kirsten, how many people lined that route? Do you know? Do we have a count on those?
Don't have a count, but definitely thousands, because, I mean, he went through all different parts of North Carolina, and he stopped at different places that were monumental to Billy Graham. So, you know, you felt like people got a chance to say goodbyes from the very beginning of this whole 9 days of mourning we've had. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely a very interesting experience, and also just very emotional. You saw a lot of people, you know, take their hats off or put their hands on their heart and just taking that moment of seeing his car go by.
And, of course, his body was in his boyhood home for the first 2 days of this week, Monday and Tuesday, before it went to the Capitol Rotunda in Washington. And that was open to the public. Aside from Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, how many people came through through the library or to the library for that purpose? Do
we know? At least the first day, we know it was more than 5,600. So that was almost 6,000 the first day, probably close to that the next day. So, I mean, thousands of people came to see Billy Graham and pay their respects to him. And even while the former presidents were there, mm-hmm. you could still be on the grounds. It was just kind of put on pause. But a lot of people, I think, didn't mind waiting because, again, right. you're in the presence of former presidents, you know, while you're paying respects to this great
person. It's an historical moment.
It is.
So if you're... The purpose of going to that library really is to look back on history, because it's a remarkable look at his life and his mission in life at that library. Two previous presidents, as I said, came to pay their respects in Charlotte this week. President George W. Bush was here on Monday.
If there's such a thing as a humble shepherd of the Lord, Billy Graham is that person.
And President Bill Clinton arrived on Tuesday, and after spending time with Franklin Graham viewing the casket in Billy Graham's boyhood home, he spoke to reporters about criticism that Graham had been too close to politicians.
Those of us who are Christians believe in a God of second chances, and the politicians need those more than anybody else, so you got to cut him a little slack for trying to give a willing ear and an open heart without regard to his political preferences.
Former Presidents Barack Obama and Jimmy Carter did not come and are not planning to come to Charlotte today. David, do we know why?
I'm not sure about Barack Obama's reasons, but I did hear that Jimmy Carter's wife has been sick, had surgery recently, and perhaps that was on his mind instead of coming here to Charlotte.
So Billy Graham Parkway is closed today in both directions at this point in time. How does a person get to the airport if they have a flight to catch? How do you do that?
If you're coming from the north on I-85, you should be good because the road is closed there at Woodmont in that area. So your access to the airport is uninterrupted. If you're coming from the south, you're going to have to take a detour onto Tivola Road and then up to the airport area that way.
And how long will it be closed to traffic? I know they closed it, I believe, last night to make preparations for this and put security checkpoints up. But how long will it be closed? When will it reopen is the short question, I guess.
It will reopen after the president leaves. So sometime, I think the ceremony here will end around 2 o'clock. So probably give it at least an hour after that, maybe longer.
And for as long as Air Force One is on the tarmac at Charlotte Douglas, does that cause flight delays or any other problems with the traffic?
I'm sure there'll be some hiccups, Mike. I'm not totally sure of the details on that.
Okay. So what's the schedule today? You're at the Billy Graham Library right now. The funeral begins at around 11:50 or 12 o'clock noon. What's the schedule for today?
Right. So they'll start playing prelude music around 11:40 or so. The Graham extended family will come in first. Then at 11:50 a.m., President Trump and Vice President Pence and their wives will be seated ceremonially by Billy Graham's grandson, the Major Edward Bell Graham. Then right after that, Billy Graham's casket will be escorted into the tent from the library where it is right now, and the immediate family will be along with that.
I think we just lost David. I'm sorry, David Borax is at the Billy Graham Library. If you can hear me, David, check back in with us if something of note happens between now and the end of this program today. David Borax from WFAE News. Billy Graham, of course, had the honor of lying in honor in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. this week for 2 days. And now there is talk about putting up a statue in the Statuary Hall in the Capitol building of Billy Graham. We have two. I think each state gets two statues of favorite sons, and our favorite sons are probably not favorite sons anymore.
No, we have two former governors, Zebulon Vance and Charles Aycock. And Charles Aycock was known as the education governor. He was also known as a virulent white supremacist. So actually in 2015, the North Carolina General Assembly approved a request to replace him with a statue of Billy Graham. Of course, that could not happen at the time because you can't have statues of people who are living. So now that Billy Graham is no longer living, Governor Roy Cooper has actually put in the formal request with the Joint Committee on the Library of Congress to say we would now like to make that replacement.
So who makes the decision about whether or not they are going to approve that? And if so, who do they remove? Who makes those decisions?
I'm assuming it's the Joint Committee on the Library of Congress, but I can't imagine there would be resistance to that.
So what's interesting about that is how our definition of how we look at favorite sons changes, as you alluded to, Mike. People we put there in a previous era may be somewhat out of favor now. I wonder how Billy Graham will be viewed in future generations.
I don't think I'll be around to find out, but that's okay. David Dvorak is back with us, and David, we lost you in the middle of the itinerary for the day. If you want to finish up and tell us what's
on the schedule,
that's okay.
Anyway, the program includes tributes from family members and friends and associates of Billy Graham from around the world, and the keynote sort of presentation will be given by Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son, who is now the heir to the family ministry.
Okay. David Dvorak, if anything else happens while we're on the air today, check back in with us, please. Thank you.
Will do. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome. David Dvorak from WFAE News. Let's move on to the reaction to the president's suggestion about arming teachers. The shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, has resulted in a flurry of marches and meetings by students with legislators and congresspeople and with President Trump at the White House, after which the president suggested that not all teachers, but some teachers be armed.
The headline was, Trump wants all teachers to have guns. Trump wants teachers to have guns. I don't want teachers to have guns. I want highly trained people that have a natural talent, like hitting a baseball or hitting a golf ball or putting. How come some people always make the four-footer and some people under pressure can't even take their club back?
That, of course, has caused a debate around the country, including here in Charlotte. The controversial sheriff in Broward County, Florida, is opposed to the idea. North Carolina State Superintendent of Public Schools is also opposed. So is CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox. He believes it's a terrible idea.
I just don't think adding more guns to an already volatile situation makes sense. You know, I think it confuses the situation for an officer who has to respond.
He said that during a Facebook Live event with CMPD Chief Kerr Putney, who reiterated his opinion that guns don't belong in classrooms.
That doesn't make sense to me because we had 800 guns stolen last year. And where are you going to secure them? It's a practical matter.
So is this a non-starter in Charlotte?
I think it's a non-starter with most people who have any experience with the actual idea of using lethal force and or with actual students. I think it's mostly something that gets a lot of attention and a lot of talk.
Are there school superintendents and or police officers or chiefs or sheriff's departments anywhere else in the country who think this is a good idea? Because some areas of the country do allow teachers to carry guns. Yeah.
I don't know about that, but I do know that the McClatchy papers, us and the News and Observer, are working with Elon on a poll of North Carolina teachers. So early next week, we should actually be able to put numbers to what teachers think of this idea.
Mark Johnson, the state superintendent of education, says he's against teachers carrying guns, but he believes the state should provide more money to hire police officers to make schools safer. He's a Republican. Has there been any reaction from our Republican legislature to the need for more money to put police officers in our schools?
I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything yet, but I think people are saying they'd rather beef up security than to arm teachers. I think that is where the conversation is going, is how can we put more resource officers in the schools or put more, you know, armed officers in general, but arming teachers is not something people are talking about.
Kirsten Garris is with Spectrum News, and Os Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer, and Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro. We'll talk a little bit more about this idea of guns in schools and some of the questions that need to be asked before that happens, if it ever happens. And we'll talk about CMS security when we come back. It's Charlotte Talk's local news roundup, the Friday news roundup here on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and Os Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, and Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro. Just a minute ago off the air, you said you're not sure, Glenn, that this idea of arming teachers is a non-starter in North Carolina.
Well, I think we've seen with HB2, I hate to mention that.
You get to put the quarter in there.
I think we've seen with HB2 that our legislature is willing to enact laws or ordinances, whatever, that they think will benefit their constituents. So I'm not sure that they won't pass some type of law or saying that teachers are permitted to bring guns into school. Not just North Carolina, but I think in conservative states around the country, we're going to see teachers have the permission. Mm. Whether the teachers will take them up on it is a different issue. But I think we will see legislation enacted that will allow teachers or allow the systems to decide.
As your colleague Tim Boyum, who does State House reporting regularly every day on Spectrum, has he heard from any legislators about how they're feeling about this,
Kristen? Not to my knowledge, and I can't speak for we've been doing a lot of Billy Graham coverage, so I cannot speak to that. But I think it's something that is a conversation people are having. Obviously, they started that House committee to discuss school security, so it's on the minds of a lot of people at the State House and obviously here in Charlotte of what we do next.
Well, there are a lot of questions that would have to be answered. On Meet the Press Daily, NBC's Chuck Todd raised a lot of very practical questions that he says have to be answered by every school board in the country before arming teachers. Just listen to this list.
What type of gun would teachers carry? How much ammo per teacher? Who pays for the guns? Who trains the teachers with the guns? Who certifies the teachers with guns? How much more money do teachers with guns make than teachers without guns? Do all the teachers know which teachers are carrying? Do all the students know which teachers are carrying? Where are the guns stored? Does each classroom have a gun safe? Who knows the code to the gun safe besides the teacher? What happens to the guns overnight? Would armed schools now need 24/7 armed security to protect their guns? Is this just for high schools? What about elementary schools? What about preschools? Will armed teachers be present on field trips, at after-school activities, at sporting events, at sports practices, at music recitals, at school plays? Can a teacher lose his or her concealed carry status if he or she has disciplinary problems? How about domestic problems? Will parents need to sign waivers in case their children are accidentally shot by teachers? Can we rely on teachers to be able to shoot one of their colleagues if they lose it? Can we rely on teachers to be able to shoot a student?
There were more questions. We had to cut it off.
You could go all day.
So maybe it is a non-starter.
Take your answer back.
Yeah, really.
So all, questions, of course, can be answered, but can they be answered to the parent's satisfaction? I mean, one of the key questions is in that whole diatribe there is, do parents have to sign a waiver in case their child is shot by a teacher inadvertently in the line of fire?
Yeah, you think about how many friendly fire deaths there are in combat from people who are trained to be in combat. You think about how often have we on this show talked about police shooting someone that in hindsight you say maybe he reacted too quickly, maybe he reacted under stress. Now, again, you're talking about teachers, and like the president said, not all teachers. So what if the shooter comes in and Mrs. Jones has a gun and Mr. Smith doesn't, and Mr. Smith's kids are killed? You know, are you then going to say he should have had the gun?
And on television, I have heard somebody, and I don't know whether, I don't remember if it was an official or just a man on the street kind of thing, say, well, you know, I'm willing to lose a student's life in the line of fire as long as the guy firing the gun gets the shooter. That, I think, is something you can say when it hasn't happened.
Yeah, I think all of this, if you are fantasizing, you know, that this will be like a movie or a video game or something, it seems really cool. We all want a picture, 110-pound Miss Jones, you know, pulling out her gun and capping the shooter. But it's just, you know, you don't want bullets flying in a school.
It's not uncommon in the African-American community for parents to talk to their children, especially their sons, about how to engage armed law enforcement or how to act in an encounter with armed law enforcement. With armed teachers, would that be an additional conversation we have to have with our sons, how to conduct themselves around armed teachers who suddenly feel threatened?
So given the complexity of this, the reality of the complexity of all this, when you actually take, I don't know, 5 or 10 seconds to think about this, and you come up with that list of questions that we just played from Chuck Todd, is this anything more than a diversionary tactic or a delaying tactic to say, well, we're considering all these things, and then nothing happens again? Is that what this is about?
I think we have to wait and see, but I will say students are making sure that this conversation keeps going. That's the one group we haven't talked about yet today is students are talking about this. They are holding these March for Our Lives demonstrations. One is coming up. I know there'll be a walkout March 14th. There'll be a national march on March 24th, and a Myers Park high school senior here is organizing one, and she said she had to do something because they are tired of seeing students like themselves being hurt or killed in these shootings, and they said something has to change. So they're pushing for common sense gun laws, and they want to know, how can we stay safe? And actually, one of the students I talked to said, you know, she doesn't want her teacher to be thinking about dodging a bullet or having to, you know, carry a gun. She said, I come to school to learn, not to, you know, think about my teacher dodging a bullet. So students are talking about this, and we've seen the students from Parkland be very vocal. So I think we will continue to hear from this issue for sure.
And there have been results, but the results are coming from the marketplace, not from the government, which is probably something that makes at least conservatives very happy, because Walmart and Dick's Sporting Goods have both said they're raising the age of gun sales to 21, and they're taking away large capacity magazines, and they're taking away any kind of assault weapons.
But on the other hand, we saw what happened in Georgia, when a private company, Delta Airlines, decided that it would back away from its preferred rates for NRA members, and they took away a fuel tax break for mm-hmm. the airline. We may look back on this and think that and see that this was all just a diversion, but I've learned not to underestimate the NRA. It's a very, very powerful political organization, and we do have states that are deeply, deeply embedded in the gun culture. So while we might not see it in New York, we might not see it in California, we do have states where it would not surprise me at all if legislators did pass legislation authorizing teachers to carry guns.
Okay. On that Facebook Live conversation, we heard two clips from a moment ago, one from Clayton Wilcox and one from Kerr Putney. Putney spoke about the importance of being proactive and preventing a school shooting. Did he say how they were being proactive, Ann?
He and Clayton Wilcox have been talking, I think, fairly frequently, and what they have said is that they are going to work together and they are going to come out with a plan, and they're going to take it to, and this doesn't require the U.S. Senate, this is probably county commissioners. So they have not given a lot of details. In that Facebook Live conversation, Chief Putney was a little more forceful about some of the specifics than the superintendent was, again, because logistics get complicated. He said that it's time to stop talking about whether we're going to fence these campuses that have multiple buildings and multiple mobile classrooms and talk about what those fences are going to look like. Clayton Wilcox didn't say no, but he also didn't say absolutely positively. And it was a $13 million proposal 5 years ago. Will they come in with something like that? There are just so many times when students and parents and volunteers are moving around that it might or might not provide the security. The chief talked about wanding, like you do to get into a government building where you walk through a metal detector, and if you ping anything, they wand you. You know, if you've gone to one of these meetings where there are 300 or 400 people, you see the line back up, and now you think about a high school with 3,000 students getting wanded and searched. All these ideas that seem really great are complicated on the ground.
I don't know what CMPD was doing before the Florida shooting, but since then, they've certainly stepped up their effort to let the press and the public know that they are taking threats seriously. Just this week, there was a press conference where they talked about, I think it was maybe 3 or 4 incidents where they have been in contact with students who made threats against schools.
Well,
our
Alex Algan here at WFAE reported this week, CMPD is investigating threats to 2 CMS schools that police believe were made by students. A 14-year-old female student at Southwest Middle School in Steel Creek was arrested in connection with a threat found on social media's Snapchat site. That comes 2 weeks after a 19-year-old shot and killed 17 students in Florida, obviously. And it said the student was charged with making a false report concerning mass violence on an educational property, which is a felony. They also found a gun on a school campus this week, the sixth this year, right?
Yes. And this is a perpetual challenge, I think, for the schools and for the police and for the media. How much attention do you give to things that, in the normal course of things, you know, kids make bomb threats, they say stupid things. You don't want to sort of inflame the panic. But on the other hand, then you have someone like this 19-year-old in Florida who just gave a million warning signals and then actually followed through. So guns being found on CMS campuses, it's certainly not a daily event, but it's not unheard of.
There have been 6 so far this year, 19, I believe, last year. No gun has ever been discharged, ever been fired on a campus, I don't believe.
Not recently. In 2003, there was a gun, apparently an accidental firing at East Mecklenburg High School. It kind of ricocheted around and grazed a couple of kids. In the late 80s and 90s, there were some actual fatal shootings. I believe these were all after hours on school grounds, but not. We have not had somebody come into a school, aim a gun at somebody, and try to kill them.
As our Teacher of the Year guest earlier this week, Bobby Kavner, pointed out, that schools used to be built like castles. They were self-contained buildings with one entrance. Once you were in, if you closed that door and barred that door, nobody was getting in. But today's schools are these multiple building campuses where you have to change classes. You have to go outside to another building or to a trailer to do this. And securing those are very difficult. And we've been talking about fences and walls and what kind of a fence do you put up so it doesn't look like a prison that you can't put the rifle of a gun through and fire at students from the outside. But the threats so far in this country to students have not come from people on the outside. They've come from students who brought guns in, who blended in with the other students. Even though this guy in Florida was no longer at that high school, he was high school age. So he could blend in.
Right. And we have had outsiders. I think the Sandy Hook was an outsider coming in just to attack.
But he was a kid.
Was he a kid? I did not remember. Well, Sandy Hook's the elementary school.
Yeah, I think he was maybe 20.
He was certainly young.
Yeah.
And I think he was a former student. I think he may have had a connection to the school. Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's where what Clayton Wilcox says and what CMS people have always said is our best defense is relationships with the students. So that they know, and usually this is what happens, is that a student, for whatever reason, puts a gun in their waistband or their book bag or whatever, and another student goes to a teacher or an administrator or a school resource officer and says, hey, you need to check out this guy, you know, the gun's in his locker now or whatever. So usually these guns get intercepted without any violence.
You reported that 5 years ago, following Sandy Hook, CMS embarked on a $19 million plan. Really? $19 million? To fortify schools by installing locking systems on the main doors that required an ID card or authorization from inside to get in. Was that fully employed? Is it working? What cost $19 million? Locks?
I think security cameras, locks, the panic buttons, so that it's really easy and quick to notify law enforcement if there is a genuinely dangerous situation. I believe all the buildings have these. And what I started to hear almost immediately afterward is, but wait. You know, if you have one of these schools, and these are high schools and middle schools and even elementary schools with mobiles, you know, it's not always been considered practical. I think Alexander Graham, I heard from people there who had said, we're not even locking our front doors. Literally just this morning, I was at West Charlotte High School talking to some teachers about whether they would like to be armed, and I pushed open the front door and walked in because it was near the time when students were still arriving. I think then those locks were put into place later. So again, there is no system in which the school is constantly fortified and the school can be what we want schools to be.
Clayton Wilcox says schools will do more active shooter drills, and they're producing one on tape to be shown to all school employees. Did he explain what a drill might entail and what they'd want students and staff to do during these drills or during an active shooter situation?
I think that's going to be what that tape would show, and I think it will be something where you'll actually have somebody with obviously a fake gun and where you would have, you know, police coming in and dealing with them. He has said when the students met at an emergency meeting to talk about this, a lot of them said, look, we've been blowing off these lockdown drills. We want to actually enact what we might be able to do if a gunman were in our school. Clayton Wilcox says, no, I'm not doing that. That's too traumatic for students. But students, potentially, at least the older ones, will be able to watch this and be told, you know, I think there's the basic drill. What is it? You know, hide, evade, and last resort, fight.
Right.
I guess everybody's probably had to think about that.
The guns that have been found historically in CMS schools have, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, been scattered through the system. Has there been any discernible pattern about where most of the guns are, or are they everywhere? And they go down to third grade. Kids in the third grade are bringing these guns in.
Yeah, and again, the list of guns that were found last year, you know, yes, the ones, you had a lot of high schools on the list, which is what you tend to expect. You had Randolph Middle School, which is a high-performing magnet school in a very nice neighborhood. You had three elementary schools. And again, what the kids are thinking, I don't know. You know, I remember one time writing a story about, you know, a gun was found hidden in a box of crayons at an elementary school. You know, are they protecting themselves against bullying? Are they, you know, look what I found at home and I'm going to take it to show my friends? it is scary that the guns are that prevalent that they can find their way into the lives of almost any school.
Okay, well, we'll be talking about this in the coming weeks, I know, as this conversation continues nationally. This week, citing low morale, leaders for the Fraternal Order of Police told City Council that CMPD officers need a raise.
The ship is sinking and their lifeboats in the water, but they're not from Charlotte. They are from other places that are providing the pay and the benefits needed to take your officers.
That's Daniel Redford, who I believe is with the Fraternal Order of Police.
And CMPD.
CMPD. Mm-hmm. So morale is low, and other departments are luring away cops from CMPD. There's evidence to back that up. That's actually happening.
Well, that is from the FOP. Those are the members who are quoting those numbers. But, I mean, there are police departments it is common to have people go from other police departments, and CMPD is trying to recruit from other police departments.
And is morale low because pay is low? Is that why, or are there other factors?
They're saying pay is low. I know last year the FOP actually went to city council with similar, you know, requests, and they said morale is low after the Keith Scott shooting. They felt like, you know, people didn't trust them. People were kind of against them, and that's fair to say because last year was a very... Or 2016 was a very volatile year.
They're also asking for better health care, the reinstatement of retiree insurance, and for the top salary pay plan to be reduced from 13 to 7 steps, I guess, so you can get more quickly to the higher pay levels.
Correct.
They also want take-home cars for officers who live inside the city limits. Why do the police need to be able to take their squad cars home?
They didn't get into the specifics about that. I think they're just talking about quality of life requests, things that like extra pay, better health benefits, being able to take home your car. One of the other requests was also overtime for working on holidays or your day off. And police cited things like, they said city council wants to bring the, you know, RNC possibly. They're bringing the All-Star game. They said who's going to staff those events plus continue to be present in neighborhoods. They said CMPD officers need more support financially from city council.
Well, they need more officers, evidently.
That too, and that's the thing. Recruitment has been low and it's been a challenge, and Chief Putney has talked about that before. He hasn't been quiet about it.
I want to talk about the salary levels when we come back. Also, the report that CMS released on race and poverty, which does not paint a very pretty picture. We'll talk about those things and other things as well when we come back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Friday News Roundup with Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. Ann Doss Helms is here from the Charlotte Observer, and Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News. Charlotte, we were talking about the low morale at CMPD and the request for a 15% pay raise by the officers, dramatically high. Is there a reason for it being so high?
They said it would bring them up to other cities. The FOP quoted things like Raleigh and Cary, who were offering more money. At CMPD, you could a starting salary is about $43,000, and you could make as much as maybe $66,000, again, for officer status. And in Raleigh, that could be closer at $77,000, at least based on what FOP is saying.
So we're a bigger city, and they're paying more.
We also have a different jurisdiction. We are the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, so we do cover parts of the county versus Raleigh is the city of Raleigh. So it's a little different.
How long has it been since they've gotten their last raise? Do we know?
That I can't say, but I know that this is a request. Again, last year, the FOP came to city council with a similar request. Not 15%, but they did ask for more resources and just more support. They felt like city council hasn't been supporting them. And city council, yes, did approve money to hire more officers, but not necessarily a higher salary. And some of these officers who talked Monday night said, you know, we can't, just because you approve more officers doesn't mean we're getting them.
Right.
And they're saying they're dealing with people who are retiring, which is natural. You know, people leave the police department, but they said some people are leaving the business altogether. Together or again going to another city. So they're having trouble with just trying to keep folks there.
Has council reacted to this yet?
Yes. We had actually one of the newer members, Tark Bakari, who was a Republican, that night said they need to take a hard look at the increase very seriously. I mean, again, city council budget discussions are literally just starting. So it'll be a couple of months before we know how much they could afford, what could be done. But early on, you're hearing a Republican saying he's ready to take a serious look at the increase.
So this week, CMS released a report on race, poverty, and opportunity called Breaking the Link that reveals some quote-unquote unpleasant truths. And Clayton Wilcox didn't pull any punches.
I think this report does point out at least two very uncomfortable truths for our community. And that is that many of our kids are really suffering from the impact of poverty and racism. And to step away from that would be criminal on our part. We have to own this today. We have to create a sense of urgency and a of passion.
So, Anne, you started your article reporting on this with this sentence: white students in Charlotte Mecklenburg's low-poverty schools have the best shot by far at getting top-notch teachers and graduating ready for college, while black and Hispanic students in high-poverty schools are left behind. Is that the gist of this report?
It pretty much is, and it's a 70-page report. I will not read it on the air. It is available on the CMS website.
Well, take your time.
Yeah. It's a lot of data that we have. Everybody has reported, has looked at bits and pieces of this. It's out there. It's known, but this is presented in a very clear and powerful way, and you actually heard Clayton Wilcox say the R word, not just race, but racism.
Right. And he used the word criminal. To ignore it would be criminal.
And that was pretty interesting strong. Because that was after Tuesday night's school board meeting. It was the third time I had heard these numbers presented. I'm sure he's heard them far more. Mm-hmm. And all of us who are used to dealing with this data have kind of done the intellectual processing of it. And at every presentation, there has been a point at which someone, usually a person of color, has just had to stop and process the visceral reaction to seeing these numbers presented so starkly. And Frank Barnes, who is the numbers guy that did this after Clayton Wilcox spoke, just said, I need you to know this is personal for me too, and turned and walked off the podium. We know this on some level, but it's so stark that in every category they've ranked low, medium, and high poverty schools. In each grouping, the white students did better than the black and Hispanic students. And in each situation, the poverty level, the black students were doing better in a low-poverty school than in a high-poverty school. White students were doing better in a low-poverty school.
So that gets us back to the student assignment plan, which was touted originally before they voted on it and changed it. It was touted as a means to break up these pockets of poverty. The plan, as voted on, does not do that. And we knew that going in, right?
Right.
So did we know all this information when they decided to skimp on the student assignment plan?
I think we did. I mean, not necessarily every single data point in here, but yeah, none of these trends are new.
Different superintendent, different school board. Would the outcome have been different today if they were voting on the student assignment plan that was altered, I think, because of politics?
Well, and that part of the discussion on the school board was that somebody said, we could not make every school a low-poverty school. We might, with a lot of busing and a lot of forced assignment, be able to make every school a moderate-poverty school. And then Rhonda Cheek, I believe, came in and said, no, we would then actually have every school be a high-poverty school because everybody with the option to leave would leave if they didn't like their assignment. And that's always been a part of the dynamic here, is not just political courage or cowardice, but parents have a lot of opportunities.
So Clayton Wilcox calls this a first step as we, quote, draw a line in the sand, end quote. What kind of line is he talking about here?
Well, that's what we're going to find out. They are doing some things already. And again, this is not something that nobody's heard of and nobody's been trying to remedy. There have been for years discussions about whether students with high potential who are black or Hispanic or in high poverty schools are getting equal opportunities at the most highly challenging classes and programs. This report would say, no, they're not. They are trying to do some things with that right away. You know, there are efforts to get more of the best performing teachers in front of more students in these schools. There have been some really large bonuses offered, and it might budge the needle here and there, but
we've been talking about this for years, and I have said this before, this is a city that the news media focuses a lot of attention on education. I've never lived in a place that talks more about schools and education than Charlotte. It's astounding, actually. But Wilcox wanted to jolt political, business, community, and faith leaders into joining the district's efforts to fix this. But we've been talking about this forever. So how is this perceived as a jolt, a shot in the arm? Did this surprise anybody? Did it shock anyone? Has it shook people to the core?
I don't think in the African American community people were shocked. We may not, as Ann said, we may not have known the exact numbers and the data points, but we've sensed for a long time that the numbers were stacked, that the best teachers were not in high poverty schools. I've heard lots of anecdotal evidence that African American students are not encouraged to take advanced placement classes. And I've heard parents say that their kids were discouraged from taking advanced placement classes. But the other thing that I would point out that that the superintendent said in the report, I think it was in the report, is that no one has gotten this right. He can't point to a school district anywhere in the country that has gotten this right. So this is not just a Charlotte problem. This is a national problem.
How are we going to fix this?
I don't know. And that is there. I don't believe there is the will to fix it. And points out that there are choices now. If you try to force a solution, suburban parents have choices.
Isn't that why there are choices?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that why there are choices?
Isn't that why there are choices?
Yeah. So that you don't have to put up with this if you don't want to.
I guess so. There have been choices since forced segregation. And there are more choices today than there were then.
We'll be talking about segregation and integration on Monday on this program with Dorothy Count Scoggins and others, including somebody from the, I'm going to forget the name of this, at the Little Rock Nine, somebody who went to the Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, about how Charlotte Mecklenburg was the poster child for integrated schools nationally. We did it really, really, really well, but we don't do it anymore. So we'll be talking about that on Monday. Candidate filings for the May primary are now closed. We have our field of candidates now, except in one race, I believe. One key theme has emerged. That's incumbents are facing challengers from within their own party. Why? Kirsten.
You know, we're seeing a lot of people wanting to step up, run for office, whether that's from the 2016 election or just people saying they want to take more of a stand. I think you're seeing people get more active and saying, hey, I'm willing to challenge the status quo. And in this year, we have county commission races up on the ballot, and that's a governing body that it has a lot of members that have been on that board for several years, several terms even.
And is this happening in both parties, both Republicans and Democrats face primary challengers?
Yes, we're seeing that across the board from Congress all the way down.
Does this hurt or help one party over the other?
It's hard to say. It makes the primaries very interesting because when you look at it, voters don't have someone in the primary race. The voters don't have the party to look to for a cue because the party's like, hey, we have three candidates, so they're really not endorsing anyone yet. So this is where voters really have the loudest voice because you decide who will go on to the November
election. And I asked about whether it hurts or helps because Democrats are smelling blood in the water, obviously. And a new USA Today Suffolk University poll released yesterday reveals that Americans are mad and looking toward the midterm elections. The polls say that although 70% of Republicans are happy with the direction the country is going in, 80% of Democrats are not. And joining them are 70% of independents. That makes it a 58-32% split, 2-1, feeling that we need to make a change. Can either party afford to muddy the waters with extra candidates if they really want to either maintain the status quo or make a change?
Hey, we'll see.
I think you could say that a primary contest, the key is do your voters get energized and turn out? Because, you know, 4 years ago, the turnout was 39%. That's a whole lot of people who, if they decide not to sit home this time around, can make a difference. You know, if they're Republicans who are happy with the way things are, that may lock in some things. If they are, and of course, locally, you're seeing, you know, Democrats who are facing challenges from Republicans.
And I think a lot of that anger you mentioned is directed toward national elections. And I think that will, I think there's less of that on the local level, but I think that will, that anger will play a significant role, as Kirsten said, in the general election come November, because more people are going to go out to vote. Now, with the primaries, you know, maybe so.
For the first time in recent memory, I'm told nearly all 170 state legislative races in North Carolina will feature both a Republican and a Democratic candidate. But given gerrymandering, will that make any difference?
I will say this. We'll see. But I know the North Carolina GOP party was very adamant about getting Republican challengers for every race. I actually saw Dallas Woodhouse. He's the executive director for the statewide Republican party. And he said they made an effort to make sure there was a Republican in almost every race. And we're seeing that. Yeah. A lot of people who probably would not have had challengers do have challengers this year.
So Charlotte may have lost out on Amazon, but we are still in the running to hold the 2020 Republican National Convention. We've been given an extension. The deadline evidently was February 28th, but the GOP extended it for all prospective cities. I want to know why, and I want to know who the other cities are, because I'm told there aren't many cities bidding for this.
Yeah, it's not that many. I know at least this is all coming from Dallas Woodhouse, who I talked to earlier this week, and he says he's hearing rumblings that maybe some places in Florida, Tennessee. It's still kind of an unknown who the exact short list of folks could be submitting. And technically, we don't know if we're in the running yet. We are going to submit a bid, so we don't know if we're going to be on a short list for RNC 2020, but it's something that Republicans feel confident about because Charlotte has already hosted the DNC. Mm-hmm. So they called it essentially like a dry run so that Charlotte is already prepared for something like
and
this.
And this week, right now, we're hosting the CIAA tournament, which is coming to the end of its long-term contract to host the city here. They're thinking about moving it elsewhere because they're saying maybe fans are bored. They've reduced the size of the seating, the number of seats in the arena, Spectrum Arena. I'm not sure why they did that, but they did it. And this tournament has been plagued with violence over the years, not connected to the tournament or the CIAA. It just happens in the environs around it. And I think last night we had another shooting.
At least a couple of nights ago, there was a shooting at an unaffiliated CIAA
right.
party, correct.
So what should we know about the CIAA tournament that's in town this week? Traffic problems? If they're reducing the seating to 10,000 people in the arena, there are going to be fewer people here, right?
Well, too early to tell. I'm not sure there will be fewer people here. I think they reduced the seating more about optics than anything else. In that huge arena, there were always a lot of empty seats. So I think, you know, kind of like in church where the pastor asks you all to come down front. I think it was done more for optics. But the CIAA has been here 13 years, and I'm hearing from a lot of local people that they're not as interested in attending. So it'll be interesting to see when 2020 rolls
around. If you have a tournament in the same city for 13 years, you've done the restaurants, you've done the NASCAR Hall of Fame, you probably want to have it someplace else after a while.
I asked someone that question yesterday. Could any tournament stay in the same city for 13 years and stay fresh? I think it's a challenge.
I want to go back to where we started this morning at the Billy Graham Library, where WFAE's David Borax is at the moment. David,
hello,
I understand.
Mike.
Hello, I understand that former governor, former mayor Pat McCrory is in attendance. He's not doing his radio program this morning. Huh?
That's right, Mike. Well, it is filling up here. I'd say the tent is about three quarters full at this point with all of these 2,000 guests, including a lot of dignitaries like former Governor McCrory. I had a chance to talk with him really briefly, and he talked about Graham as being the most influential person North Carolina has ever seen. But he also said that Graham was a man of humility, and he said that's what people liked about him. And McCrory is still doing interviews off to my right here. Looks like he's been doing them for about 15 minutes. Gwendolyn Glenn is here with me from WFAE, and she talked to Pastor Rick Warren. People might be familiar with him as the California.
You have a minute left. You have a minute left.
Okay, California pastor, the purpose-driven church. And he said it's not a sad thing for Christians to leave the planet. We know where we're going. People are going to miss Billy Graham, but he's with God now. And many of those same sentiments being echoed by people throughout the crowd today as we get ready for this noon ceremony.
For which the president will be in attendance along with the first lady, and Air Force One will be at the airport. And once again, we mentioned that Billy Graham Parkway in both directions is shut down today until after the funeral. So if you need to use Billy Graham to get to the airport, you're not going to be able to do it. Find an alternative route. David Borax from WFAE News on the scene there. Thanks to Glenn Birkins, publisher and editor of QCityMetro.com, and Dawes Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, and Kirsten Garris, government reporter, among other things, for Spectrum News Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour.